Senator Tammy Duckworth says she's been denied access to a Chicago-area detention facility where immigrant children are being kept due to the Trump administration's family separation policy.
I'm waiting to go to visit one of the detention centers to see how these kids are being treated. I've been denied access now to visit Casa Guadalupe in the Chicago suburbs now for quite a while, and I'm hoping I can go on Monday. But how they went about doing this was just shoddy at best and frankly inhumane.
Senator Duckworth joins us to talk about that, foreign policy, and more domestic issues. Plus, are you looking for a new place to eat? Maybe you use a review site like Yelp to help you pick. Now, Yelp has announced it'll be posting hygiene scores of restaurants on their website. We want to hear from you about how you use Yelp. Maybe you're a restaurant owner with thoughts about the site or someone who uses it. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or join the conversation on Twitter at 21STShow. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we're going to be talking about eating out in the age of online reviews. We'll hear from food writers and restaurant owners about what it's like when everything is on Yelp or other review sites. We also want to hear from you. Do you check Yelp before finding a new place? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. We're also going to be introducing a new show that's going to be airing Fridays from our friends at NPR Illinois in Springfield. But first, this morning, we're catching up with Senator Tammy Duckworth. There's been a lot going on in the country and the world these past few months, whether it's immigration, gun control, or a new nominee to the Supreme Court. And it's also been a while since we had a chance to speak with Senator Duckworth. I caught up with her yesterday afternoon, and this is the first time she's been back on the program since giving birth to her daughter, Miley, earlier this year. Like many moms, Senator Duckworth worked steadily throughout her maternity leave. So I started by asking how her daughter was doing.
Oh, thank you for asking. She's doing great, or as her pediatrician says, she's chunking up nicely, which is about the only time in a woman's life when you want your doctor to say that to you.
Have the other senators adjusted to having a baby in the Senate? Have you had to bring her onto the floor?
Well, I have had to bring her onto the floor. I don't do it all the time, but usually, you know, every so often I do. It's just the way the votes work out if she happens to be with me. So they've adjusted, but the problem is they've adjusted so well. Every time I show up, they just want to take her away from me and snuggle her. And so half the time I have to figure out which senator has taken my baby and is, you know, in the corner cooing to her.
That sounds like a good problem to have.
Yeah, and you would be surprised who some of the biggest culprits are.
Who's her favorite, or who's adopted her as his favorite?
Well, Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont. She really likes him, and every time he picks her up, she snuggles against his shoulder and goes to sleep, which is really interesting. And Marco Rubio was fantastic with coming up to me, and you know, someone I rarely ever agree with on anything, was so supportive of changing the rules to bring the baby onto the floor. And so she's been a wonderful icebreaker.
Well, and it sounds like maybe a little bit of a bridge builder.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about something that's actually been very divisive, and it's that issue of gun control, which has been part of our national conversation so much this year. And this week, we've seen a unique version of that debate because it has to do with 3D printed guns. Earlier this week, a judge issued a restraining order against one company's plans to release 3D printed gun designs online. But on Tuesday, you and 21 other lawmakers introduced a bill that would ban plastic guns. And I wanted to ask, didn't Congress ban the sale or manufacturing or possession of fully plastic guns back in 2013? How is this different?
Well, they're selling the plans. So they're not actually selling the plastic guns themselves. This company is selling the actual plans so the people can actually pay for, download the plans, and then go home and print off their own 3D guns with a couple thousand dollar 3D printer, and they can do that. And so that's the difference. They're actually just selling the plans. And really, they want to circumvent the ability of states to regulate this and say that, states don't have a say in whether or not these plans can be downloaded.
And so what's the goal of the legislation that you all have introduced?
Well, to prevent the spread of these 3D printed guns, they're dangerous. Not just for the potential victims, but also for the shooters. These guns also tend to blow up when you fire them. But in this time with terrorist threats, in this time with such radical racist, you know, movements happening in this country, to have easy access to completely undetectable guns that can make it through, you know, metal detectors and the traditional ways that law enforcement prevent firearms from entering into, you know, onto airplanes and the like is really dangerous for the American public.
I also wanted to ask you about the issue of migrant children. There are at least 700 children and teens across the U.S. who are still separated from their families, at least 17 of those right here in Illinois. The Trump administration is under a court order to reunify these children with their families. I know the administration has said some of these families are, quote, ineligible for reunification. What can the U.S. Senate do in this situation?
Well, we can hold them accountable and we can force them to reunite these families. And frankly, I'm appalled at the inhumanity of how this administration has gone about doing this. Some of these families that they say are ineligible, it's because they went ahead and they deported the parents while they kept the kids in custody, or they outright lied to the parents and told the parents, if you sign this paperwork, and allow yourself to be deported, we'll send you your kids within 2 weeks. And months later, these parents are back in, you know, their various home nations and are still waiting for their children. They gave these folks documents that were not in their native language that they didn't understand. They outright misled these parents. They ripped nursing babies from their mother's arms and completely against any of the values of our country. And so I'm deeply appalled. I'm waiting to go to visit one of the detention centers to see how these kids are being treated. I've been denied access now to visit Casa Guadalupe in the Chicago suburbs now for quite a while. And I'm hoping I can go on Monday. But how they went about doing this was just shoddy at best and frankly inhumane.
And Senator, one conversation we've had on the 21st this week is about these shelters and about who's responsible. And it seems that it's a little murky in terms of who's responsible for the children in these shelters. There's DCFS in Illinois that does some licensing. There's the Department of Health and Human Services. I think that's part of the confusion even over who can give you permission to visit the shelter, correct?
And that's done on purpose. That's what the administration has done on purpose. They have purposefully created a system between DHS, which is the federal agency, Department of Homeland Security, and HHS, Health and Human Services, another federal department. They have created a very murky process to prevent, I suspect, us from being able to visit. This really is a federal issue. I'm so glad that states are trying to step up and regulate this. But frankly, this is at the administrative issue in terms of the Trump administration, and they purposefully did this in such a way as to make it difficult to have any transparency into what is happening.
I wanted to just switch gears for a minute and ask you about some more international affairs, and particularly Iran. President Trump has continued his Twitter diplomacy this week. First, tweeting that Iran should never, ever threaten the United States, but then also inviting President Hassan Rouhani to meet with him. Given that in May the president announced our withdrawal from the nuclear deal, but there's also, I think, other news, including a new report out from Reuters that talks about the at least five Americans that are currently being held hostage in Iran, I wondered how you think we should proceed here.
Well, I think the president is over his head when it comes to foreign affairs. I mean, he did this whole thing with North Korea and Kim Jong-un. And look, a report just came out this week saying that the North Koreans are still pursuing development of a intercontinental ballistic missiles that can hit the United States with accuracy. So obviously what he's tried to do on his own has failed. And again, with Iran, you know, Iran is not our friend. Iran is holding Americans. The best thing we can do is to have an international regime that holds them accountable. We can't go up, and we shouldn't do this on our own. After all, Iran is in the backyards of our European allies, and they should have some skin in the game as well. And so for this president to, again, not only go it alone as the United States, but in many ways himself, against the advice of his diplomatic experts is very troubling, because I don't think he has the skills to deal with this issue. And frankly, we are not in a place where we can afford to have an Iran that manages to maneuver around the U.S. And to think that, you know, they're going to do anything that's in our best interest, because the president of the United States has invited them to a summit is frankly optimistic isn't even the word for it. I think it's naive.
And you mentioned North Korea. How are you feeling about how the security threats? How are you feeling about North Korea these days?
Oh, I think the security threat is still there. And remember, we have hundreds of thousands of Americans in that region, not just in South Korea, but also in Japan, for example. Frankly, North Korea is not our friend. North Korea is not a legitimate actor. They are not an honest broker. We cannot trust them to keep their word. And we, while we should engage with them to try to keep them talking to us, we can't ever weaken our alliance with the Republic of Korea, South Korea, or our allies in Japan when we stand firmly against North Korea and their ability. You know, they want to encroach, and they certainly have not backed off on their development of their intercontinental ballistic missile, which, you know, the only reason you develop an ICBM is to deliver nuclear warheads. And the only reason you do that with the range that they're working on is to hit the United States. So they're a real threat to the American homeland. They're an immediate threat to American and American allies in the region. And we, frankly, should not be trusting the, you know, third dictator in a family and someone who's has been as ruthless as the current dictator in North Korea has been. We can't trust him. So I don't understand why our president is making nice with this guy.
And apart from the president, do you feel like there are others in the administration? This has been part of the confusion of the Trump administration in terms of diplomacy. But do you feel like there's a clear message from the United States right now when we're thinking about diplomacy and it comes to North Korea?
I don't think so, because if you talk to our military leaders, and this is where my, you know, where I have confidence, is our men and women in uniform who are standing there shoulder to shoulder with our allies 30 miles from the DMZ, our military leaders have made it clear that we cannot yield to North Korea, that we cannot give them any leeway. Yes, we should engage with them diplomatically, which is what all the military commanders have said to me. But that doesn't mean that we do things like cancel our military exercises, which is what this president wants to do. We just can't show any willing to back off and give North Korea any type of advantage, which is what our president is doing, and against the stated positions and recommendations of our military leaders. And frankly, they're the ones on the ground. They're the ones who have to fight these battles on behalf of the American people, and we should probably listen to them.
Senator Duckworth, as you say that, I wonder, we've certainly seen a lot of conversation about the intelligence community and President Trump, and some in the intelligence community certainly feeling undermined. Do you feel like that may be true of the military community as well in the U.S.?
I think so. And part of it comes from the president himself. He's actually tweeted statements that undermine our military leaders. You know, he says that he listens to them, but then he questions the decision making of our top generals. And frankly, I don't think he's in a position with the experience and with the knowledge or even the willingness to do the homework himself of learning about what our military is actually truly doing on the ground, and the challenges that we face around the world, and the alliances that we have around the world with other militaries and other nations that have kept the world at peace. And frankly, I just don't think this president is equipped to move forward on his own as a commander in chief. And frankly, he has very well qualified individuals like General Mathis that he, you know, I feel like he sort of stops listening to them when he wants to. I mean, it's almost like he operates on a whim.
Senator, I wanted to ask you something about a question about military veterans here in Illinois. And as you well know, there's been 14 veterans who have died at a state-run home in Quincy. Those deaths were linked to Legionnaires' disease, and that's happened over the past couple of years. State lawmakers have worked on measures that would do things like standardize when families are notified about issues like this and possibly even raise the amount of compensation that families can receive. I wonder what thoughts you have about the next steps that should be taken to help support these families and prevent this from happening again.
Well, this is something I've been working on very closely now for a while. part of the changing of the legislation came about as a result of what we learned in terms of reporting. In fact, the Quincy Veterans Home, the former administrator, you know, they would report that a veteran died of natural causes. But then the county coroner was the one who actually said, no, actually, this person died of Legionnaires. And then the Quincy Veterans Home would not actually report that death and leave it to the county coroner to make the report. And that's simply not acceptable because the people who are still in the veterans home, who still have loved ones in the veterans home, in those same facilities where the other veterans died and contacted this disease, deserve to know. Basically, what Quincy needs is to rebuild a veterans home. That facility is a Civil War era facility. The people who work there do very good work. They are tireless and they are amazingly dedicated individuals. But the buildings themselves are old. The piping is old. And in fact, we asked the Centers for Disease Control to go in and take a look at what was happening there. And the Centers for Disease Control said that there is no way to completely eradicate Legionella from the actual infrastructure that that exists at Quincy. And the best thing you can do is just to build on new facilities. And so that's where Dick Durbin and I have been working very hard. Both we were able to obtain federal dollars for remediation in the short term, but we're more than willing to work to bring in federal dollars to help build new facilities there so that our veterans have a safe place to live out their golden years. And after all, they deserve nothing but the best.
Do you have confidence in the Rauner administration that they'll be able to carry this out?
Well, they're saying all the right things now, but only after it blew up on them. And frankly, their initial response was to hide and not be transparent. They've been forced to be transparent. The person that's been put into place there now at Quincy by the administration is someone that we've been able to work with. So I'm happy that the previous VA Department of Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs director has stepped down. She was very much part of the hiding of the truth from us. And so I think there's a new transparency there. Whether or not there's going to be follow through, I don't know. I can only tell you that Dick and I are absolutely dedicated to bringing in the federal resources to match anything that the state comes up with and state legislators come up with.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up this conversation with Senator Tammy Duckworth. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You've been listening to our interview with Senator Tammy Duckworth. We had a chance to catch up with her yesterday afternoon. It's been a while since we spoke with her, so we covered a whole range of topics. And I asked her where she stands on the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to replace Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court.
Well, I am not supporting his nomination based on me having looked at some of his past decisions. He has written to say that, for example, he thinks that a president of the United States is essentially above the law, not only cannot be prosecuted, but cannot even be investigated. If that were true, then we would never have been able to investigate either Richard Nixon or Bill Clinton. Nobody in the United States is above the law. That's the whole core of who we are as a democracy, as a nation. No one is above the law. And he's written in his works that the president of the United States is essentially above the law. I think that he, in his past writings and his past decisions, has shown a willingness to degrade health care. Coverage and healthcare access. And I just don't think we can go back to the bad old days when an insurance company can tell you that your child with asthma isn't going to get an inhaler, or that if you have a pre-existing condition, you're not going to get the care that you need. And I'm really afraid that Justice Kavanaugh, as justice, he would vote in along those lines. And so I can't support him. I just think the American people want us to do our due diligence and read all of his decisions and all the documents pertaining to his work in the Bush White House, and unfortunately, the majority is not allowing us to access those documents. So I don't know how I can vote for someone if I'm not allowed to look at their body of work and do my due diligence.
There was also some question about the nomination itself and waiting until the midterms. Do you feel like that question has been settled in the Senate and the votes will go forward?
Well, I don't know that settled is the word for it. I think Mitch McConnell has made it clear that he wants to seat this Mr. Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court before the midterm elections, because he is afraid that he will lose the midterm elections and lose the Senate. And that means that there would then finally be a requirement that we get a chance to look at the full body of Mr. Kavanaugh's work and get a real accounting. I think they're trying to seat him without us being able to do a due diligence to you know, see what it is that he's talked about and done in the past and how he might vote. Remember, this is a lifetime appointment for a relatively young man. And I just think that we need to really be able to put great consideration and do a serious look at him. And unfortunately, Mr. McConnell is not allowing us to do that.
I just wanted to ask you one last quick question. If speaking of the midterm elections, are you going to be campaigning for any House Democratic candidates back here in Illinois?
Well, I will be doing that. I think we have some great candidates. I will be home next week with Brendan Kelly in Southern Illinois. I think he's great. He's a former state's attorney. He's done a lot of work on the opioid epidemic. He's done a lot of work on trying to lower drug prices. And he I think I mentioned he's a Navy veteran. So I think he's a great law and order guy and the kind of person that should be supported and would be great in Congress. And so you'll see me across the state talking with folks as well, both on the official side, but then also I'll be doing a little campaigning on the side. Yes.
Thanks for joining us, Senator Tammy Duckworth. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. It's good to be on.
Are you looking to try a new place to eat this weekend? How often do you scroll through reviews on Google or Yelp to help you pick something to try? And what if while you were searching, you also saw a list of demerits and health code violations next to that 5-star review, say, about fettuccine Alfredo? At the end of July, Yelp announced that some businesses in Chicago are starting to roll out health scores on their review pages. So far, Yelp began using, quote, hygiene scores for businesses in other big cities like New York, California, Texas, and Washington, D.C. And the company says that eventually 3/4 of the country will have access to health scores through Yelp. So how is this actually going to work? And perhaps the bigger question, how might these scores affect business for local restaurants? Joining me on the line now to talk about this is WBEZ reporter Monica Ng, who also co-hosts the food podcast Chewing. Hey, Monica, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla.
Michael Gebert's also with us. He's editor of the online magazine Fooditor. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Monica, let's start with you. Yelp's been around for more than a decade at this point. How common a source is it, do you think, for people to use when they're looking for a place to find a place to eat?
Well, when people are looking for a place to eat, they'll often Google it, and Yelp has some really good SEO, so their stuff often pops up first. But Mike?
I'm sorry. I thought you said Michael first. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the universal, you know, way to check the basic info on things, get the hours or the number or whatever. How much do people read the reviews? How much do they want to read that, you know, Cindy J thought this is the greatest pizza ever? I don't know. You know, there's a tendency to only write 5-star or 1-star reviews to either gush or to slam a place. As I think is typical of most sort of, you know, general population rating systems. So, you know, you can use it to find certain kinds of information. You can use it to find if a place does a certain thing. But, you know, who are all these people? How much do I care what they think? That's a good question.
Right.
We professionals like to believe nobody uses it.
You all are professionals. So we've been asking people about this on social media. We posed this question to our listeners on Facebook. Mickey says she reads reviews mainly to just see what dishes reviewers recommend. And Michelle says no and no. I just ask friends. But we'd love to hear from those of you listening right now. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. And whether you're a restaurant owner or someone who eats at restaurants, we'd love to hear both of those perspectives. We do have a couple restaurant owners joining us in a few minutes. But do you also, Michael, let's start with you. It sounds like you do, you use Yelp just for informational purposes, but not for the reviews.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain times, I'll give you an example. If a new place is open in Chinatown, I'll look through the reviews and see if there's somebody. A lot of times there will be someone who maybe grew up in China and moved to Chicago or whatever, who actually knows what they're talking about, you know, who knows the region or something like that. And I'll definitely look at what they have to say. There are also kinds of information that you can mine from the reviews sometimes. I've written posts on, you know, kind of the neighborhood pizza place that nobody talks about in different parts of the city. And those are the kind of reviews. I mean, I don't care that somebody thinks that's the greatest pizza on earth, but if somebody says, yeah, old Joe, he's been in the back making the sausage himself since 1958, I mean, that tells you something about the place that's worth knowing about and checking out. So, I mean, there's definitely information to be mined there, whether or not I listen to most of the people who are saying, I really know my Chinese food. I eat at P.F. Chang's all the time. So,
and Monica, yeah, let's go ahead, Monica.
Mm-hmm. It is funny. I do look for Asian names on Chinese food restaurant reviews to see if I should believe them.
I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say a lot of people do that. I do that as well. I look at the pictures. So maybe that's a terrible racial profiling on my part when I'm looking at Yelp reviews. But Monica, can we ask about health scores specifically now? Because now this is going to be another element of information that's going to be on. Chicago is one of the test cities for Yelp. First of all, how does the city grade restaurants for health scores?
Well, we're on a pass-fail system. We're not like New York or a lot of California municipalities that do the letter grades. And so I think it's going to be really difficult. I've just been, you know, kind of pouring through, and let's say Goosefoot Restaurant, they get 100 according to this 1 through 100 score, and they had a pass on their last inspection, but a Home Run Inn that has passed with conditions, they got a 94. I'm not sure how they're actually calculating these things. That's going to be a bit controversial, but in Chicago, it's actually very cumbersome. I did a story when these things first went online about 7 years ago to go through the data portal, to look up the name of the restaurant, to understand all the different terminology between canvas, reinspection, licensing inspection, and then just trying to understand the wording for what they found is kind of crazy, and the mechanics of scrolling through it is very difficult. So you can find this stuff, but how they're translating into these 1 through 100 scores, I think it's going to be very controversial.
Michael, what do you think?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's one thing if the city was assigning the ABC scores, as they do in many parts of the country. That would just be reporting a fact. But the way Yelp, which, you know, has had issues, you know, a lot of restaurateurs believe they'll slam things based on whether or not you buy ads. Whether that's true or not, this process is incredibly opaque. They have some weird algorithm they're not sharing with anybody about how they take all these factoids and make one number out of it. You know, I don't see how that isn't going to raise suspicion about what that information really is.
And do you think, Monica, this will make it easier for people to find this information or not really? Like, do you think this, I don't know if this would lead people to go to the city's website. It sounds like the city just has a pass-fail system. So that's kind of basically the city of Chicago says if this restaurant is open, we think it's safe for you to eat here, basically.
Yeah, basically. And, you know, I would hope that, let's say they do see, let's say, an 84 score. I haven't seen any of those yet. That they would go to the portal. They would take the time to try to search for the specific violations that restaurant or that food service establishment has ostensibly committed. But being able to understand that, I mean, I'm a journalist who has, like, walked through this with the health department, and I still don't understand some of the language.
Okay, well, that doesn't bode well for the rest of us. We're talking to Monica Ng, who's the host of the podcast Chewing. Michael Gebert's on the line with us as well. He's a food writer and editor with Fooditor. We'd love to hear from you all listening. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can keep the social media comments coming as well on Twitter to our handle 21STShow. I wanted, as I mentioned, this is rolling out in Chicago. We wanted to invite some restaurant owners from throughout the state to join us to provide their perspective. In studio with me here is the chef and owner at Baccaro Wine Lounge in Champaign, Drew Starkey. Hey, Drew, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you.
Daniel Krause is also on the line from his restaurant Cracked. The Egg Came First, also based in Champaign-Urbana, where they have a food truck as well. Hey, Daniel, thanks for being with us, too.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Drew, can I start with you? Just your thoughts on Yelp in general. I saw you nodding when Michael was talking about, and we were talking about this before we went on air, just the idea that Yelp is calling you all the time, trying to get you to advertise with them, but just your feelings about Yelp in general as a restaurant owner.
Yeah, I haven't really heard about this until you guys called yesterday and asked me to be on. And it doesn't look like they have done it in Champaign yet, but yeah, we get pretty constant calls and emails from Yelp asking us to, you know, do things with them. I actually have the business app on my phone, and it'll tell me, you know, how many leads we have from their, you know, from their page, which is, you know, all to be checked at. You know, I don't.
Really... So you think they're in the business of selling Yelp, not right. necessarily your restaurant, is your perspective.
That's
on
how
this.
I feel about it. Yeah.
Daniel, what kind of impact do you think Yelp has on your restaurant business?
I am like 100% sure that Yelp is the biggest driver of internet searches to a restaurant in general. Like if someone's going to go online and look at a place and find, you know, where I'm going to eat today, I think Yelp is by far the number one place that people will tend to go to. I don't think it necessarily has a giant effect on sales on a day-to-day basis. But I think it does drive people from out of town. People are coming in from, you know, the north or south, and they're driving through, and they quickly come up on Yelp. But if you actually live in Champaign and you kind of know the restaurants in Champaign, I don't think you're generally using Yelp on a daily basis to find out where you're eating.
Mm-hmm. We just got a comment from Spencer on Twitter. He says he uses Yelp reviews when he's out of town and wants to get a general sense idea of quality. But I only write my own reviews when it's a local place that I've been to multiple times.
Totally. And I think that is not the norm for sure. And I wish that most Yelp reviewers would give a place one or two or three or four tries and try a few things on the menu before going to a place and saying, oh, they were out of French toast and I got a small crispy tot instead of a large, 2 stars. You know, it's like, well, maybe you could come back and maybe we'll have French toast next time and, you know, like give us another chance before you just roast us based on, you know, one little thing.
Right. So Michael, Monica, that's what you guys do that's what professional food writers do, right, Michael?
Visit a few times, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In theory, you know, the economics of all of this have changed so much that, I mean, there's a whole listicle industry of people writing the 50 best barbecue places across America. Mm-hmm. I guarantee you no one got in their Pontiac and covered the country to write that list, you know, for which they made $100 or something like that. You know, I think one thing about this kind of citizen media, yes, one person may be biased, but you have a crowd that will visit it. So, I mean, in theory, if a restaurant has 75 reviews, I mean, there's 75 visits at minimum that talk about what the restaurant is about. So in some ways, it's far more comprehensive than any publication could be.
Yeah. And you know, that crowdsourcing does help. You know, it's really interesting. I'm comparing Chicago's food inspection scores to what it says on Yelp. I'm finding all the places that have recently failed their canvas inspection, which means routine inspection, and Yelp has not put up any health score for them. I wonder if they're pulling their punches, and you know, as this rolls out, or they haven't had a chance to do it. But that's somewhat interesting to me. And you know, what Mike mentioned about there have been multiple accusations that Yelp has threatened business owners to either hide their good reviews or play up their bad reviews based on who advertises. They did a story about this, talked to dozens of business owners, many who would not go on the record, but a few brave ones did, and Yelp just simply flatly denied it. We don't do it. Everybody's crazy. And with this kind of this capriciousness that could be potentially there in deciding the 1 through 100, that's only going to increase, you know, the suspicion that, oh, they're using their leverage on the advertising end to give them 100 versus 75.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. And Daniel and Drew, I want to ask you about negative reviews and how you respond to them. We'd love to hear from you. You can keep the conversation going on social media. Our handle is 21STShow. If you want to join us live, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about Yelp reviews, and we'd love to hear how you use them, how important you think this is when it comes to restaurants. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about Yelp reviews, a site's decision to add health scores to its restaurant reviews. Drew Starkey's in studio with me here. He's a chef and owner at Baccaro Wine Lounge in Champaign. Daniel Krause is on the line with us from his restaurant Cracked. The Egg Came First. They've also got a food truck in the Champaign-Urbana area. On the line from Chicago, we've got food writers Monica Ng and Michael Gebert with us, and we're taking your comments as well. Drew, can I start by asking, just to this point of health inspections, how does that work at your restaurant? How often do you get them?
We get two surprise or impromptu inspections a year, and one of them, and the third one's an educational. So, like, you either go into the health department and sit down and talk with your inspector about a review and go over it and what you've done to correct things, or they bring you their topic that they want to, you know, kind of promote that year or whatever. So it's, you know, it's pretty simple and straightforward. The last few years, it's been a little tricky because they're trying to switch it all over so the whole state is in the same...
A standardized system?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's been a process for them, I believe. And, you know, each time they come back, they're like, oh, it's going to be the next time. The next time is when we're going to switch to this new system. And it was supposed to be this year, and it hasn't done it yet. So I know it's been tricky for them. So,
Daniel, how does it work for food trucks?
Well, the food truck itself gets inspected once a year, and then the restaurant gets, same as Drew, two times, and then the third one is that it's just like a educational meeting, basically. But I own a warehouse which operates a commissary kitchen, and I rent that out to other food trucks in town. So whenever I get a new renter, I get a health inspection in there, and then all of them also have their own yearly inspections on their truck and in the kitchen. So the warehouse gets inspected, I mean, at this point, like 7 or 8 times a year because of the amount of renters that we have. But the truck is just once. It's not too bad.
And Daniel, as you're listening to hearing Monica describe how they're going to do this in Chicago anyway, and the idea is eventually this will be rolled out all across the country, what is your thought as a restaurant owner as to Yelp adding these hygiene scores to restaurants?
Yeah, it makes me laugh a little bit, to be honest. Like, I just think it's ridiculous because, like, what was said earlier is that, like, all of these health inspections are kind of different. And like Drew just said, like, they're just now standardizing the health scoring in Champaign to be the same as Illinois. And it's going to take a long time to do that. And if you look at, like, that's just a micro scale. So if you look at Yelp on a macro scale, like, how could they possibly have a health score for a place in New York City and a health score for somewhere in Austin, Texas, and then in Sacramento, and expect anyone to, like, relate them and say, well, that person got a 63 and that person got an 85. Like, but they're all different health departments. They probably all have different regulations. How could anyone make a decision based on these completely arbitrary numbers that we're assigning to these restaurants? So, you know, I think Yelp is a very useful tool to get people to your restaurant. But at the same time, I think they are, they're not here for the restaurants. They don't work for the businesses. And I think this is another example of Yelp just, like, doing something that they think is in their own best interest. And whether it's good or not for the restaurants, it doesn't really matter to them.
Monica, what do you, is that what you hear from other owners as well, that Yelp isn't here for the restaurants?
Well, off the record, they say horrible things about Yelp. On the record, I think they're scared of them because they know that, you know, in a lot of ways they can exert a lot of influence. I mean, it was just like the thing where a lot of them had been pressured to buy advertising under threat, but they didn't want to come out and say it. I'll say it. Restaurant owners that I've spoken to are not huge fans of Yelp.
Drew, I see you nodding as everyone's having this conversation, and I wanted to ask you about what you do when you handle a negative review. We just got a comment from Renika on Facebook, and she said, yes, she does use Yelp reviews. If other customers thought the place was unhygienic or had pests, that is a big no. I find it an easy way also to find out if they have something applicable to my diet. I love to see pictures so I can imagine the dish I have in mind. I don't write online reviews unless I was horribly unhappy with the restaurant. And sometimes things like how friendly the waitstaff is to diverse and ethnic populations can help determine if we visit that restaurant. Reviews can be very important. What happens if you, how do you try to respond if you get a negative review?
I try to assess it first, you know, really kind of read through it and see what the issue was. Translate it to make, you know, that night, go through our records of what they had, you know, just try to research.
See if it seems reasonable.
Yes.
But you were saying to me before we were off air, sometimes you'll get reviews and people will say, I didn't like the soup and you don't serve soup at
right.
your restaurant.
We change the menu quite often. So, you know, we try our best with our customers to let them know what they're having and talk through the menu and answer questions. And then when you read a review that kind of says something like that, you know, it's confusing to me as an owner. If we didn't have that on the menu that night, then, you know, either we did a bad job of describing or presenting the food we were serving, or they mistaken us for a different restaurant, or they're just making stuff up. So I try to assess as best as I can. And then if I feel like I need to take action and reply and you know, correct a wrong, then I definitely do that for sure and use reviews to do that. I do read through them to gain information about, you know, how our restaurant's doing as a whole. And you get a good snapshot of it in a way. You know, we have a lot of reviews on both Yelp and OpenTable. And so, you know, we kind of can get a good sense of what's going on. And we try to handle them as we need to.
And for Ricaro, you use OpenTable for reservations as well.
That's
so
correct.
That's yeah. another that's another way people, that's another service people use. And speaking of that, as we talk about OpenTable, I wanted to ask you all about other social media. And Monica, Michael, I wonder if you guys can just weigh in here. How important you think Yelp was created a long time ago. And I think now, especially when people are thinking about food, Instagram seems to be much more popular. What do you think about what's sort of the dominant social media now for where people are thinking about restaurants? Monica?
Well, you know, all I hear is Instagram, Instagram, Instagram. I recently talked to the chef from Dunkin' Donuts who had come out with the donut fry. And I said, oh, well, they're like, well, you know, great to talk to you, Monica. We got to get going. I said, well, where are you going next? Oh, we're going to be going to do a party for Instagram influencers. So they've become hugely, hugely influential because I think, you know, to a large extent, if you choose to follow someone, it's because you trust them. It's because you like them. They have similar a taste that you do. And so I, you know, for better or for worse, that stuff is becoming influential. Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that it's not just Yelp out there. There's so many different ways to find out about restaurants, and you can sort of pick your own peer group, medium, whatever, you know, appeals to you. You know, I certainly have friends who check out places or, you know, people I follow in the media, including Monica. And, you know, that's a group that has influence on me much more than people taking pictures of, you know, the pretty new thing. There's a dish here in Chicago that a place called Belmore that's like an oyster caviar pie. And I have to say, if you want proof that Instagram works, that thing, which was basically made to be put on Instagram, we were sitting by the kitchen and they just flew out of there at, you know, some
what was it, Mike?
Price.
It was a...
It's a tiny little slice of pie. I think it's $68, and it has an oyster on it, and then it has caviar on top of that.
And they were moving those out like 6 and 8 at a time whole evening that we were sitting there. And I think it's because everyone's seen it on Instagram, so you have to have it.
Right, you have to be seen photographed eating the caviar on Instagram. That's a whole other talk show segment.
Yeah.
Daniel, can I ask you about Twitter? I know, especially with a food truck, Cracked is you all use Twitter as the truck's moving around. Do you like having other mediums as well to communicate with folks?
Yeah, Twitter is nice because Twitter is like a voice to your customers. Like, it's just straight to your customers, and that's it. So especially having a food truck, you know, you're not always in the same place. You sometimes got to close down early, weather is bad, generator dies or whatnot. And it's just a way to, yeah, to speak to your customers directly and say, hey, sorry guys, you know, we're shutting down. It's a thunderstorm, or we'll be out 20 minutes late today, or we'll be at this spot instead of this spot. But it's definitely much more of a specified voice to your customer base than any of the other forms of social media, I guess, especially to me and having a food truck. You know, Facebook's more, you know, post what's going on, and Instagram is, like you said, like, yeah, post a new shiny hip thing that you got going on, and your website is more informational about you, and Twitter is just, you know, hey, this is where we're going to be today. Check us out.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah, both all of you for joining us to talk about this conversation, and all of you who chimed in on Facebook and Twitter. And I want to thank Daniel Krause. You were just listening to from Cracked, Drew Starkey from Baccaro, as well as Monica Ng and Michael Gebert. Thanks, you guys, for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yep.
Thank you.
Before we go today, there's a new Illinois Public Radio program that's debuting tomorrow. It's called Statewide, and it's a production of NPR Illinois in Springfield. Regular listeners of the 21st across many of our partner stations will hear Statewide on Fridays instead of the 21st for the rest of the summer. So we wanted to make sure you all were introduced to Statewide. And for many of you listening, there will be a familiar voice behind the program, Sean Crawford, who is hosting and joins us now from NPR Illinois in Springfield. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Nyla.
Can you tell us what's the idea behind Statewide?
Sure. I think what we decided was that there's a lot of journalism being done by public media across the state of Illinois, and somehow that needs to be put together to spotlight that. And that's really what we're looking at, to take reporters from across the state of Illinois, look at the work they're doing, play that back for people in a way that they can hear from reporters who know their areas the best.
So you were going to be featuring stories from public radio reporters throughout the state primarily.
That's right. And of course, you mentioned we are originating in Springfield, so state government will be part of that as well. But really, we're looking at a lot of other conversations and a lot of other pieces that people will get to hear. Maybe they might miss otherwise.
To give us a little preview of what's coming on tomorrow, one of the stories that you're covering is a reminder of an event that took place 50 years ago this month, the Democratic National Convention of 1968 in Chicago.
Dan Rather.
What's your name, sir?
And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me.
Dan Rather.
Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please.
These are security people apparently around Dan. And obviously getting roughed up.
We tried to talk to the man, and we got bodily pushed out of the way. This is the kind of thing that's been going on outside the hall. This is the first time we've had it happen inside the hall. I'm sorry to be out of breath, but somebody belted me in his stomach during that. What happened is a Georgia delegate, at least he had a Georgia delegate sign on, was being hauled out of the hall. We tried to talk to him to see why, who he was, and what the situation was. And at that instant, the security people, as you can see, put me on the deck. I didn't do very well.
That's Dan Rather from the Democratic National Convention in 1968. Sean, I have to say, the journalism nerd in me who loved Dan Rather as a kid growing up, that's one of my favorite archival, one of my most favorite archival sounds ever. You spoke with Taylor Pinsonneau, who covered the convention for the St. Louis Postage Match. Did journalists have any idea what they were getting into?
No, I don't think so. They knew that there would be protests coming, and from talking with him, and he was just, let's look back at this, he was just 27 years old when he went to cover that in 1968. And, of course, he's had plenty of time to reflect on that since, but at the time going in, he knew that things could get heated. He knew there was going to be protests. He knew there could be disruptions, but I don't think too many people expected what happened there and really what it turned into.
And you also spoke with Mark DePew of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. Imagine you talked to him also. We're going to be hearing more tomorrow about the historical ramifications of the convention as well.
That's right. And he's talked to people throughout the state. He collects oral histories for the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. And, you know, he points out how it really changed not just political discourse, but civil discourse around the country and conventions, certainly, for years to come up to this day.
That's Sean Crawford, host of the new public radio program statewide that's debuting. Again, a reminder to our regular listeners of the 21st, many of our partner stations are going to be airing statewide on Friday instead of the 21st for the rest of the summer. Please check your local schedule. Sean, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Nyla.
And that does it for us this week. Next week on the program, are you getting ready to send your kids back to preschool? The state's spending more money in total this year, but the way they give out that money has left some districts in the dark, with some even getting no state dollars for the coming year. We're going to be looking into that. We're also going to be speaking with Chicago filmmaker Bing Liu. His documentary about Rockford, where he grew up, called Minding the Gap, did so well at Sundance. It's been picked up by Hulu, so you can tune in for those conversations and more. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here on Monday.